We're ready to hear arguments, United States versus Pedro. Go ahead, Mr. Early.
Sorry, I was just anxious to get going. I'm William Early. I'm an assistant federal public defender. I represent Jason Scott Pedro. Mr. Pedro has a couple of issues for the court. The first being whether there was a procedural error or whether the sentence is procedurally reasonable. Secondly is substantive reasonableness. Now, with respect to the procedural reasonableness issue, Mr. Pedro submits there's been an error in the calculation of his sentencing guideline range. The large capacity magazine enhancement was applied to increase his base offense level from what would have been 14 to 20 in this particular case. I believe that this issue requires the court to examine the definition of a firearm under Title 18, Section 921A3. And that particular statutory provision has four subparts to it with respect to how a firearm is defined. And it is our contention that this court should rule that the large capacity magazine enhancement applies only to a firearm as defined in 921A3 subpart A. The cases where the large capacity magazine enhancement has been applied, and there have been a couple that have been put out in the briefs, the Davis case and I think the Evans case, those cases and others like it start with the proposition that you have a whole firearm that is missing some parts. So the object in those particular cases is a weapon that will or is designed to expel a projectile. It's just incapable of fulfilling that function or that designed function because there are certain parts that have been removed from
But do we need to debate whether or not what he had was a firearm? Didn't he in fact admit that it was a firearm? In fact,
yes.
He pled guilty to that charge.
Yes, he admitted. He admitted to possessing the receiver, and the receiver is one of the inclusions in the definition of a firearm under 921A3. It comes in subpart B. But most of these cases, in fact, every one that I've seen, are all dealing with what we traditionally think a firearm is and how it's defined in subpart A. We don't have the situation where we've had a whole firearm and then parts of it have been removed or it's been disabled somehow or it's broke. What we have is just a single part that has yet to be made into a firearm with the addition of numerous other parts and probably quite a bit of assembly time.
I don't understand that because you told Judge Briscoe that he admitted it was a firearm. And now you're saying, well, King's X, it doesn't count.
No. For purposes of the enhancement under the large capacity magazine enhancement, it is our contention that it only makes sense if that enhancement applies to a firearm as defined under subpart A of 921A3. All of the provisions.
Wouldn't that approach somewhere be articulated in the guidelines?
Well, it is not, and the guidelines refer only to 921A3, the general definition. It doesn't go any further, but it doesn't make any sense to read it any other way, and I'll explain why. First of all, this particular piece of metal that was at issue here, in and of itself, is not designed to expel a projectile. It only assists in the expulsion of a projectile if numerous parts are added to it, and many, many numerous parts. So the part of the definition in subpart A, any weapon which will or is designed to expel a projectile, doesn't fit with just the plain receiver portion of 921A3B. The second half of the definition, in 921A3A is, or may readily be converted to expel a projectile. Similarly, it doesn't have any application here either. Readily generally means quickly or easily or effortlessly. The facts of this case do not support a finding that this piece of metal could easily or effortlessly be converted to expel a projectile. It would take, again, probably a trained individual with a lot of time and a lot of parts on their hand to make this into something that could expel a projectile. I think it becomes even more clear that this particular enhancement should be limited to the definition of a firearm under subpart 921.3a only when you look at the other subparts of the statute. We're dealing with subpart B, which is what he was convicted of possessing, the frame or receiver of. But when you go on further down and look at the other definitions of a firearm under 921A3, subpart C includes a firearm muffler or silencer. Now, I don't think anyone, if you were convicted of possessing a firearm as defined under 921A3C, I don't think anyone could argue that if you had a large capacity magazine, that somehow that thing could be attached to a silencer or a muffler to expel a projectile. It absolutely makes no sense. You go on further down and you look at the definition of firearm under 921A3D, that gets you into destructive devices. And the guidelines refer to destructive devices as under Title 26, 58, 45. You look at those particular items, that includes, bombs, grenades, rockets, missiles, mines. So the definition of a firearm under 921A3D, nobody could argue that you could attach a large capacity magazine to a bomb or a grenade or a rocket. It absolutely makes no sense. So the only
was this argued below? Did you argue that this receiver should not be treated as a firearm?
For purposes of the enhancement, absolutely, yes. The distinction between 921A3A and B was clearly made in the argument to the court. So,
and you make that argument in the face of the fact that you conceded it was a firearm.
Yes, we never, we can't. I mean, 921A3A and B, A3, has the four subparts. We clearly fall within subpart B. We're not disputing that because it was the lower receiver, and subpart B of the definition of a firearm clearly states that the frame or receiver is defined as a firearm. If we were going to argue that, we would have probably filed a motion to dismiss and argued that this doesn't even count as a crime. We're not doing that here. What we're arguing about is the enhancement of the advisory sentencing guidelines by use of this large capacity magazine enhancement. And it just clearly doesn't fit factually or legally under Section 921A3B. So again, what Mr. Pedro is asking this court to do is look at these subsections, look at how they cannot be applied logically if you're looking at subsection B, C, or D of 921A3, and limit the ruling or limit the use of the large capacity magazine enhancement to just those firearms as defined under 921A3 subpart A.
You rely in your brief on the case out of the Northern District of Ohio?
Yes. And I want to make this clear. I'm not arguing that this is not a firearm because we conceded that, and that's what he pled guilty to. Rowald simply was cited for the fact that there's even a district court who doesn't even think that this particular piece of metal, the receiver, even qualifies as a firearm. So it's
But the issue there, the court was looking at a regulation, and that wasn't raised in this case, was it?
No. The only reason I have cited that case is to just make the point that when you're trying to apply this firearm large capacity magazine enhancement here, it makes no sense to apply it simply to the frame and receiver portion of the definition of a firearm. So, now, with respect to whether there was error, we certainly brought up substantive reasonableness of the sentence, but I don't even think you really get there in this case, because I think that the procedural error requires reversal. If the court procedurally erred by applying the large capacity magazine enhancement, then it's going to be up to the government to convince the court that it's harmless by a preponderance of the evidence. And I think if you look at this court's law with respect to whether or not an error is harmless, it's very clear that the 10th Circuit believes that there are very few cases where a miscalculation of the sentencing guidelines is not error that requires reversal.
Well, Gisborne is obviously one. So, Mr. Early, tell us why we shouldn't consider that any error harmless under Giswine. So Judge Friant had relied on, in Giswine, on his willingness to go to the statutory maximum. Maybe he would have even increased it if the statutory maximum had been higher. Judge Russell was pretty unequivocal, saying that except for the guilty plea and his crediting the defendant for a reduction based on the guilty plea, that he would have applied the statutory maximum. And so we have from Giswine what Judge Friant had explained. It doesn't seem terrible. He used more words than Judge Russell, but I'm not sure he gave any more substantive explanation than Judge Russell did. So why isn't Giswine indistinguishable for purposes of harmlessness?
Well, I think because if you look at that particular case, the judge went into a lot of detail as to why he chose the sentence that he did, and that he would have picked something even worse if he had the opportunity. He referred to the sexual abuse of a child, the abuse of the relative who had cancer, all of these other things. And if you look at what Judge Russell did in our case, you go to volume 3, page 31 of the Record on Appeal, you see really maybe just a few sentences as to why.
Telling sentences saying that there's no more incendiary combination than the combination that was present in this particular case.
Well, I don't think that it when you look at the degree of the variance or departure, and it's not really clear. I mean, Judge Russell said he was departing at sentencing, but varying in the statement of reasons. But regardless of what you want to call it, I don't think it suffices to meet the level required by this court and also the Supreme Court. This court in the Pena-Hermosillo case, quoting Gall versus United States, said that major departures should be supported by more justification than minor ones. In this case, there's no linkage between your what Judge Russell refers to as your history includes drugs, violence, and guns to anything recent. As argued to Judge Russell, the last violent type of offense Mr. Pedro had was many, many years ago. And his most current crimes that he had been facing while facing this same federal charge were not crimes of violence. They were just run-of-the-mill criminal activity that didn't engender any sort of thought that he's running amok and posing a risk to people on the streets, perhaps property, but not people. So I think that here, given the fact that we went from what I say is a 30 to 37 month correctly calculated range all the way to 87 months, certainly is not justified by just the language that Judge Russell used. But I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mary Walters and I represent the United States in this case. There are two issues before the court today. One, was the district court correct in applying the sentencing guideline enhancement for the possession of a semi-automatic firearm capable of accepting a large magazine? And two, was Mr. Pedro's sentence of 84 months substantively reasonable? I agree with counsel that the firearm as defined by Congress is found in Title 18 of the United States Code 921A3 and that subsections A and B do apply in this case. Subsection A being any weapon which will or is designed to or may be readily converted to expel a projectile by action of an explosive, or subsection B, the frame or receiver of any such weapon referring back to subsection A. Both apply in this case in that referring to subsection A, the evidence presented at sentencing was that the receiver or the firearm in this case could be converted readily to expel a projectile with the proper parts. And second, in the subsection B, that this item is a lower receiver of an AR-style rifle. And the fact that the sentencing guideline enhancement does apply to all of Section 921A3, the fact that both subsections A and B apply in this case would lend it to be that the enhancement was properly applied. In determining that a lower receiver, in this case a firearm, is a semi-automatic firearm. And the fact that it was capable of accepting a large capacity magazine is shown by the fact that under United States Sentencing Guideline 2K2.1A4B, comment note 2 specifically, a semi-automatic firearm that has the ability to fire many rounds without reloading because at the time of the offense, the magazine or similar device could accept more than 15 rounds of ammunition was in close proximity. Mr. Pedro was found to be in possession of not one, but five fully loaded 30-round high-capacity magazines that appeared to be new, along with his new-looking firearm. While this court has not specifically squarely addressed this issue, the 11th Circuit and the 8th Circuit have. The 11th Circuit in a 2020 case, United States versus Evans, specifically deciding that capable of accepting a large capacity magazine are, quote, words of possibility, not actuality. Here in Mr. Pedro's case, it is possible for the firearm to be capable of accepting a magazine, capable having ability, fitness, or quality necessary, not attaching, not holding, accepting. And the lower receiver, also referred to as the firearm in this case, did have that ability in that the receiver of the magazine for a firearm is found on this part of the weapon. Therefore, it can be received and not necessarily need to be held, as there is nowhere in this definition that holding.
So if you had an upper receiver that was incapable of holding the magazine, that's not a firearm?
Your Honor, it could fall under a firearm under subsection A, depending on the facts and circumstances surrounding that particular piece in that case.
I thought you were making a distinction or a point about being able to receive the magazine.
I was referring, Your Honor, to capable of accepting, and the firearm in this case is clearly capable of accepting based on its design and the fact that it falls under the firearm as defined in 921A3.
Could you move your hair away from the microphone? Because we're getting static. Thank you so much.
I'll actually put it up, Your Honor. I came prepared.
It took me a while to figure out what was going on. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But I still understand if we were talking about only the upper portion rather than the lower portion, it will not accept the magazine, correct?
If it was the upper portion, that is correct, Your Honor. However, okay. In this case, that we're at the second hurdle. The first hurdle is deciding whether or not the firearm possessed by Mr. Pedro is in fact a semi-automatic firearm. And then moving to the second issue, which is met in this case, would be the lower receiver capable of accepting a large capacity magazine. So I think in the instance that you're presenting, Your Honor, the upper receiver would meet that definition of firearm, however, may not necessarily be able to receive or capable of receiving a magazine in that condition. However, fixed to fire with the appropriate pieces, as in the United States versus Davis case, the Eighth Circuit 2012 ruling, that fairly good condition be fixed to fire, it may fall under being fixed to fire, but we would need the specifics of the surrounding of the possession of an upper receiver in that case. Further, under United States versus Davis, application note 2, for a firearm to be capable of accepting a high-capacity magazine, it must meet 3 criteria. 1, the firearm must be able or capable of being fixed to fire. 2, at the time of the offense, the magazine with the capacity of 15 or more rounds must either be attached to or in close proximity to the firearm, as was in this case. And 3, the firearm must be
capable. And that point is not really debated, is it? The close proximity?
No, Your Honor. That was agreed upon, I believe, by both, and that close proximity was not an issue, correct, Your Honor? And the firearm is must be capable of accepting the high-capacity magazine, the one referred to in close proximity. All 3 are found in this case. Again, as Your Honor pointed out, there were magazines, 5, in fact, in close proximity. The firearm, as the testimony given at sentencing, would be able to be fixed to fire with the proper parts. And 3, the lower receiver could accept a magazine in this case. In that, Davis applies to all of Title 18 United States Code 921A3 and not a specific subsection. It is relevant to this case and supports the government's stance.
Ms. Walters, these magazines had ammunition in them, didn't they?
They did, Your Honor. All 5 were fully loaded 30-round magazines.
If we were considering only the ammunition versus the lower receiver, would the result be different than what you were asking for in this case?
If we were considering only the ammunition, Your Honor?
Yes.
I don't believe so. I'm not sure I understand your question, but I don't believe so based on the question you're asking.
Well, you could definitely support a possession of a firearm or ammunition, but would it be a semi-automatic enhancement if you just had the magazines?
No, Your Honor, because there would be no firearm in that case, as defined by Congress.
So that's the reason why you choose to talk about the receiver in this case.
Well, and that's what he was charged with and pled guilty to, Your Honor.
But I mean, that's why you accepted that plea. That's why that's the plea you wanted.
Well, that's what he was charged.
Plea to the ammunition, correct?
We did not charge with the ammunition. We elected to elected to charge him with the firearm. Yes, Your Honor. Further, any error of the district court in applying this guideline enhancement would be harmless. Counsel for Mr. Pedro has stated that the burden of proof is preponderance of the evidence. And as in the Gieschwein case, 2018 case decided by the 10th Circuit, said that there may be harmless error when there is a cogent explanation as to why the 3553A factor analysis is tied to something independent from the guidelines. As was in Gieschwein, the district court was very specific in stating that, but for Mr. Pedro's plea of guilty, the maximum penalty of 120 months would have been applied in this case. However, he was given credit. And as in Gieschwein, the court explicitly tied its sentence to the statutory maximum, reducing the sentence because of the plea of guilty. The court explained its reasons in this case, in Mr. Pedro's case, for tying its sentencing decision, an appraisal of its history. 33 prior convictions, 28 criminal history points for an individual that is 36 years of age, felony and misdemeanor offenses, including what the district court referred to as an incendiary combination of drugs, violence, and guns. Now, regarding the amount of variance, as stated by counsel in the Pena Hermosillo case, the 10th Circuit case decided in 2008, in that case, Mr. Pena was sentenced to 120 months on a downward variance when the district court decided or ruled that the guideline range in that case was 188 months to 235 months. This was a ruling on the guidelines that was below the 324 months to 405 months, which would have given a disparity of 103 months in that case. In this case, we have a calculated guideline range of 51 to 6 through 3 months. the fact that Mr. Pedro was sentenced to 84 months, just a 21-month variance, is not a major departure or variance from the guidelines. In fact, it would not even be close to the 67 or 103 months in the Peña-Hermosillo case. The court in that case said that finding it uncontroversial that, quote, a major departure should be supported by a more significant justification than a minor one. The fact that we have a minor departure here or variance from the guideline range as calculated by the district court correctly would lend itself to show that the explanation given by the district court in this case is not only sufficient, but gets past any argument that Peña-Hermosillo would apply to reverse this case. The extent of the variance is something that needs to be considered, was considered, and is appropriate. The fact that Mr. Pedro was sentenced to a 84-month sentence is substantively reasonable. In order for this abuse of discretion to be found and for that issue to be reversed, the defendant must show that the sentence was arbitrary, capricious, whimsical, or manifestly unreasonable. We just don't have that here. In fact, the court stated that Mr. Pedro, with having 28 criminal history points, with level 6 of the criminal history category starting at 12 points, was more than double. In fact, if there was a criminal history category of 12, Mr. Pedro would likely fall within that range. And again, this is an individual who is not elderly. He is 36 years old, and the fact that he has this incendiary combination of violence, drugs, and guns at such a young age, the need to protect the public was clear, as well as the nature and history of, the nature and characteristics of the offense and the history and characteristics of the defendant, all of which are listed on the statement of reasons for the downward, for the upward variance, and were clear from the record. With that, the court considered the sentencing guideline factors set forth in Title 18 United States Code 3553. The court also explicitly stated that it considered the pre-sentence report, Mr. Pedro's sentencing memorandum, Mr. Pedro's statement to the court, and Mr. Pedro's counsel statement as well as statement for the government. The defendant in this case was very evasive with questions from the court and asking why he had the high-capacity magazines that were fully loaded that appeared to be new with a new lower receiver, also known as a firearm. And the district court, in asking the question several times, was still not able to get a clear answer. In fact, the defendant said, I took credit. I was in the car. I was driving. I think that is important to point out in that even at the time of sentencing, when the district court has the defendant before it and the defendant is at the mercy of the court at that point in imposing a sentence up to 10 years of a person's life, still would not give clear answers. The district court was very clear in why it ruled the way it did. It gave a cogent and reasonable explanation for its sentence and making the sentence more likely within the bounds of reasonable choice, as in United States versus Barnes in 2018 10th Circuit case. In that reason, again, error would be harmless. The court did not make conclusory statements that would impose the same sentence as if it had sustained the objection. It explained it would have imposed the maximum sentence, but credit the defendant for a plea of guilty decision tied to the maximum, statutory maximum, not the guidelines. For those reasons, the United States requests that the finding of the district court be affirmed, specifically that the district court correctly applied the sentencing guideline enhancement for the possession of a semi-automatic firearm capable of accepting a large capacity magazine, and that Mr. Pedro's sentence of 84 months was substantively reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, I don't have a whole lot of time, but I want to make it perfectly clear. Mr. Pedro was convicted of possession of a firearm as defined under 921A3B, the receiver portion of that definition. And again, I believe that this enhancement should be limited only to firearms as defined under subsection A. Lastly, with respect to the miscalculation of the guidelines, I would just refer the court to, and it's in the brief, there's a quote from United States versus Snowden, which is a 10th Circuit case in 2015. It will be a rare case in which we can confidently state that a guideline calculation error did not affect the district court's selection of the sentence imposed. And so I think with the error here, this court should reverse and vacate the sentence and require sentencing without reference to the enhancement.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We appreciate them. Case is submitted.